Roughly 300,000 dementia sufferers living in the community, Dementia Awareness Week reminds us how important it is to make sure they feel included.
If they've been going to the same coffee shop for a number of years, even after a diagnosis of dementia, if that coffee shop is still able to recognise the person, talk to them, remember their order, then that can make a huge difference to the quality of life.
And a new short film gives a taste of what it would be like to live without hearing.
You can get him into TV acting when you tell people you are there.
Oh, nice toys. Would you like a bag for that?
Hi, Paul. How are you today?
Hello and welcome to The Wire, current affairs across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Annie Hastwell in Adelaide. And as the Adelaide market clocks up a century and a half, we look at why we need markets in our lives. Robo-debt mistakes land the government in court today, and a public health conference hears that one group whose health is getting little or no attention is refugees. Stay with us for the next half hour on The Wire. Centrelink is set to find itself in court for their controversial robo-debt scheme. The Wire's reporter Annabelle McKinnon has the story.
Ranging from unfair debt to stress and suicide, robo-debt has taken its toll on Australians far and wide. Now, Gordon Lawyers is fighting back with a potential class action. Principal lawyer James Norton told me about the fight against Centrelink.
One of the difficulties with this system really is the way that Centrelink has used a data matching process and an algorithm to try and identify whether welfare recipients have been paid more than they're entitled to. The problem with the approach that they've taken is that the system that they've used is very flawed. It uses annual income data from the ATO and it averages that out against people's fortnightly earnings. And that can mean that people get caught up in a situation where they might be legitimately entitled to payment for a particular fortnight, but because annual information is used, annual data, it gives rise to an alleged debt.
So to what extent do you think these people affected can be compensated?
The claim that we're making is that where people who were legitimately entitled to welfare had those payments taken off them or demands made of them by debt collectors and or have their tax returns taken by the government, that that's unjust enrichment and that money should be paid back to them.
Do you expect this class action to bring a little bit of justice to the victims?
We would hope that the class action vehicle, which allows many people who have a common legal problem to approach the courts to get redress, will deliver an outcome for these people and in circumstances where it's very hard for these people often to bring cases or bring claims under their own name. The class action process gives people the ability to join together to have their common issues, their common legal questions heard before the court.
Kate, which is not her real name, was issued a robo-debt notice by Centrelink a few years ago. She told me about how her complicated ordeal began.
I got a notification saying that I might have a debt with Centrelink, and I thought I had done something wrong, but I actually checked the date and it was from several years ago. So I went back through it and I realised that it was actually when I went from being on a student allowance to going into full-time work. Within about 2 weeks of reporting that I had a full-time income, my student allowance just... But what happened was when the robo-debt thing came around is that it took my overall income for that year and it flagged it as saying my income was too high on my tax return because I was in full-time work and it said that I had a debt. Start the debt review process and all of that, but every person you talk to, you have to re-explain it right from the beginning, which was extremely frustrating. And it took about 6 months of hours and hours on the phone to Centrelink, explaining again, and trying to figure out what was going on. I was on a parenting payment, a single parent payment at the time, so had a young daughter. and they actually started taking money out of my payment after I actually flagged what was going on.
What kind of toll did it take on you knowing that you had those payments being taken out of a single parent fund that they were giving you?
It was extremely frustrating. It was actually very, very stressful. I was a single parent and a student, so I have a great support system, and I'm incredibly grateful that I had a chance to be able to study while having a kid, but it was so incredibly stressful with uni on top of that as well.
So how did you go about proving to Centrelink that they were wrong in your circumstance?
I actually had to go back to an old employer, so I left and I had to follow up and get all my individual weekly pay slips and submit them to Centrelink, which they promptly lost and they didn't tell me. So after I called back and said, hey, what's going on? I haven't heard anything. They would keep telling me, oh, you know, it'll take at least a month. So by sort of 2 months, I had to follow back up with them again. They said, we can't see anything. So I had to resubmit it again.
So they weren't particularly helpful then?
I actually filed complaints with Centrelink because it was just so bad and I was treated so bad in the process. Like, I'm all for robo-debt flagging stuff that comes up, but if they had someone on the other end, like after it was flagged and they actually just looked at what had happened, if that was actually the case, no one would go back into full-time work. Stay on Centrelink. It's very frustrating that I was getting punished for getting full-time work.
They're potentially launching this class action against Centrelink. Do you expect it to give you or any of the other people affected by this justice?
For me, justice is not what I'm looking for. It honestly isn't. I'm not looking for justice. I'm not looking for money. I just want them to change the system and have a person there or have a better assessment process.
That was Kate. She's a victim of Centrelink's automated robo-debt scheme, talking in the wake of the news that Centrelink will be being taken to court in a class action.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Well, the Australian Public Health Association is having a conference in Adelaide this week, and with the theme is celebrating 50 years and poised to meet the challenges of the next 50. Well, one of the big emerging health challenges is refugee health. Dr. Barry Fatterford is founder of Doctors for Refugees, and she told Oliver Brown and Phoebe Christoffi about her attempts to bring to light for her fellow doctors the horrors of public health for refugees on Manus and Nauru.
The couple of points that I really wanted to make was, first of all, okay, what's the justification for keeping people offshore in these detention centres? There really isn't a lot of dissent as to the conditions in the detention centres. They may not be widely known, so I put up a lot of pictures that were taken from Manus Island and Nauru, and they are predictably shocking. Nauru is actually pretty much halfway between Australia and Hawaii, and a lot of people don't quite appreciate that. So I always put up a map of Nauru because we can kind of think that Nauru, it's sort of near Fiji or near PNG. It's actually in the middle of nowhere. We all know that the conditions on Manus and Nauru are awful. Where we differ is how justified this is. And the government and the opposition, for that matter, will tell us that, well, we are justified in keeping people in such a horrendous situation solely to discourage people arriving by boat. Now, apart from the fact that it is morally indefensible to torture one group of people to send a message to another group of people, I mean, that is the definition of torture, it's also incorrect. The boats have not stopped coming. They've stopped arriving, but they haven't stopped leaving. So the whole deterrent factor is simply not there. And we need to treat patients as human beings, and that overrides all political concerns.
So what other health conditions do the children on Nauru face?
The children who were on Nauru have all manner of health complications. So dental is certainly one of them. Now, Nauru is covered with phosphate. So covered in phosphate is the environment on Nauru that they can't grow any fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, or drinking water. All of these things need to be brought in from Australia. Very often on Nauru, there were water shortages and people were told that they could only have 500 mils a day. Many of the adults and some of the children also have kidney stones as a result of that. They've almost all of them got some form of respiratory conditions. I showed pictures of the tents in Nauru, and inside the tents it was covered in mould. So toxic was the mould, when the government, the Australian government, sent someone in to clean it. The company had a look at it and insisted on their workers, quite rightly, being covered head to toe and face with protective gear. The children also have developmental delay. And so what that means is that when you see a child at four, he or she can actually do less than they can do at two. And gradually we've seen the emergence on Nauru of something called resignation syndrome, where the children progressively turn off to the point that they stop eating, they stop drinking, they stop passing urine, they stop opening their bowels. So the effect on children is quite diabolical.
Of course, Doctors for Refugees do put a lot of focus on offshore refugees, as they should, but there are also refugees currently in detention in Australia. Do you think that there should be a focus on them as well?
I would agree. Before the offshore detention centres, a lot of us were very concerned about the conditions in the onshore centres. There's a couple of things there. Self-harm in the onshore centres, even by the department's own statistics and figures, is about 770 individuals per year. So that's two a day. So yes, the situation, the detention centres onshore, is appalling.
Now, it seems like Papua New Guinea is currently trying to end Australian operations on Manus. How does that affect the work that you do?
Oh, it'd be great. Really? I mean, one of the hallmarks of our organisation being successful is obviously when we no longer are needed. Look, Papua New Guinea have been saying this for a while. It was in 2017 that the Supreme Court decided that the offshore detention centre on Manus Island was illegal and it was closed down. But still, what does it mean for the individuals there? We still have individuals who are originally from Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Myanmar, who are suddenly told, you're now Papua New Guinean. And the Papua New Guinean community haven't been consulted.
It's, of course, a very difficult thing currently going on in Manus Island and, of course, their families that are in Nauru. But do you hold out hope that it ultimately will work out for them?
Oh, I'd love to hold out hope. But the problem is that the government's painted themselves into a corner. They've got this idea that mentioning refugees is electoral poison to their party. Well, we know that's not true, because refugees were not mentioned at all in this last election, and there's really no end in sight. And I don't know how the government thinks they're going to get out of this.
Dr. Barry Fatafod, she's founder of Doctors for Refugees, and The Wire's Oliver Brown and Phoebe Christofi were down there at the 2019 Australian Public Health Conference, where they caught up with her. Dementia Awareness Week this week, the focus is on discrimination. The Wire's Henry Wilson with this story.
Almost half a million Australians suffer from dementia, and with so much publicity surrounding it these days, a lot more people are worried about potentially getting it. Kaylee Stokes is Executive Director of Advocacy and Research at Dementia Australia. I asked her what symptoms people should look out for.
There's a whole range of warning signs, and obviously we would encourage anybody that's concerned about any aspect of their health to go and see their GP. The sorts of symptoms that develop for people with younger onset dementia are the same as for all other forms of dementia, so there may be an impact on cognitive abilities, there may be changes to memory. Often it is quite a slow progressing disease, so it may be that there are some things that don't seem quite right, and that, you know, that they develop as time goes on, and family members or friends or the person themselves may just feel like there's something not right, in which case it's important to go and talk to your doctor.
With 70% of dementia sufferers still living in the community, the focus of this year's Dementia Awareness Week is on the kinds of discrimination they might be suffering.
Well, discrimination takes a range of different forms. We know that people living with dementia and their families and carers talk about discrimination in all aspects of their life. For somebody with younger onset dementia, it may be that as soon as they receive a diagnosis of dementia, they're no longer able to work. So it may be that their workplace asks them to resign from their position, even though their cognition may still mean that they are able to fulfil some of their roles, or indeed all of their roles. So that might be one form of discrimination. Certainly people with younger onset dementia report that people tell them that they're too young to have dementia, that they don't look like they should have dementia, so they face that kind of discrimination as well. And we often find that friends and family members and members of the local community start to socially isolate the person living with dementia as well as their families and carers, because they're uncomfortable about the disease, they're worried about how the person is going to react or respond, and they don't know what to say.
Statistics show that 40% of people feel awkward around a person with dementia. Dementia Australia has created a way for friends, family and others to help people with dementia feel less isolated and more included in the community.
So dementia-friendly communities are a really exciting concept, which is basically about creating inclusive communities that are supportive and understanding and empathetic to everybody that are in them. And it makes an enormous difference. So people living with dementia and their families and carers tell us that if they've been going to the same coffee shop for a number of years, for example, even after a diagnosis of dementia, if that coffee shop is still able to recognise the person, talk to them, remember their order, acknowledge that there may be some changes in their behaviour, but know that they're looking out for them, then that can make a huge difference to the quality of life and the social engagement and interaction of that person, because they're able to still maintain their usual, day-to-day lifestyle choices and routines and remain connected to their community. So that's really what the heart of dementia-friendly communities is about. It's about remaining part, an active part and a valued part of your community. So there's a whole lot of things that people can do. One of those is actually to become a dementia friend, which is a relatively easy process where you watch a number of videos about people with a lived experience of dementia talking about the importance of inclusivity, and you can become a dementia friend that way, which is really a kind of individual commitment to better understanding what dementia is and how to support people in the community with it.
And we'll put links on our site to how you can be involved in that. That was Kayla Stokes. She's Executive Director of Advocacy and Research at Dementia Australia, and she was talking to The Wire's Henry Wilson. Well, the inaugural SBS Short Film Festival over the weekend showcased 14 films from Australian creatives from diverse backgrounds.
My name is Paul, and among many other interesting things about me, I was born profoundly deaf.
One of those films, Definition, was about Paul Vagnarelli, who was born profoundly deaf. In just 10 minutes, Paul takes us into his world in an experience that's both funny and moving. Paul came into the studio today. I asked him about the fact that he appears in the film wearing a shirt that matches the wallpaper behind him.
Sometimes when you make a film, the environment in the film is the extension of the character, of the person. So I'm kind of like invisible. I know I'm part of a minority, kind of blending in the background.
It's easy to be forgotten because in the film you're sitting at a dinner party, everybody's turned away from you. So is that how you feel when everybody starts talking quickly and you suddenly are left out of things?
Yes, that happened very often, so that's why I decided to include it in the film, because it's very important to me. It happened regularly, especially in a noisy environment where there's lots of people talking and a big group of people talking. Sometimes at the beginning of the group gathering, you start talking to people individually and face-to-face. That it works for me, face-to-face lip reading, but then eventually the conversation build up and people turn away and start talking with each other. Somebody may be speaking to the group, and the majority of the group is hearing people who can talk very quickly. It's too quickly for me to repeat, so I miss out a fellow.
Must be very difficult to deal with that, because most people just forget, don't they? They start well-meaning and then they just speed up or mumble or do whatever, forget. Your film reminds people, but in real life, do you have to remind people?
Yes, I do. I have to remind people to speak more clearly, a little bit slower, not louder, just slower. But sometimes it's hard to do that, because if I want to be polite, I have to interrupt people, interrupt the conversation. It feels very rude of me to interrupt the whole group.
If you have not got one sense, like hearing, does it make the others better? Like there must be a good side to not having hearing.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like more aware visually, so I can detect movement like 180 degrees. something might feel threatening if it comes towards me and the side of my vision. So I have to look to see what's happening, so make sure it's safe.
So given that you're visually extremely aware, that fits well with your desire to be a cinematographer. Yes. Tell me about that ambition.
Yes, I've already been interested in photography and I do some photography myself. Cinematography is, I find it a new goal, ambition that I want to undertake. So I'm only at the beginning.
And what was it like to have to expose your own life, your family life, your beautiful new baby? How does it feel to expose all that on a film?
Well, I kind of have to put on a brave face to say everyone has issues in life, and I think I'm trying to show that I'm dealing with my issue and getting on with my life at the same time. So I hope it's encouraging to people. Yeah.
That's Paul Vagnarelli, whose film Definition I thoroughly recommend that you see, and we'll put a direct link to that on the Wire website. Well, markets are an important part of the country's community life these days, and one that goes back further than most is the Adelaide Central Market. If you visited Adelaide, the odds are you've been taken there because it's an institution. The Wire's Sarah Martin visited the markets to indulge in a bit of fresh produce, meet the locals, and find out how it's kept up with the times throughout its very long history.
The Adelaide Central Market celebrates 150 years of operation this year. It's the largest produce market in the Southern Hemisphere and the number one tourist destination for visitors to the city, while maintaining a staunchly local focus. It's a great example of how a market can be the heart of a city and reflects its diversity. People of many cultures and ages are working the stalls and wandering the aisles. Jodie Kinane is the market boss. She's been in the job for a year, watching the changing seasons and getting to know the locals. I asked her to reflect on the history of the place.
As each wave of new migrants or refugees come into South Australia, that then determines what new foods are coming through and what the community is looking for as far as their food goes. Those types of situations basically help create the trader mix on the market floor. We saw it in the 50s with shops like Conn's Fine Foods and some of those Greek offerings that you wouldn't have seen in other locations at the time, and that still really does drive our market mix.
There's a rumour going around that I was conceived here.
Ross Savas from Conn's Fine Foods is one of the lifetimers of the market. With 57 years on site, he was brought up there.
We've had a couple of stalls around the place, but predominantly this particular stall here, yeah, right in the middle of it all, which is what we enjoy.
Ross has had a bird's eye view of the market as it has changed over the years.
Here's some of the oldies that have died off, the food that they were used to from overseas that were buying here back in the day, that food really has gone. Yeah, that's my passion. There's all new stuff coming in all the time. And the youngsters, obviously, they have different tastes as opposed to the ancestors, you know, with the salted herrings and all that kind of stuff.
Jodie Kinane says a balance of familiarity and growth is secret to the success of the place.
The market does feel familiar when you come, so there is that important consistency with the traders over the years, and it is one of the stories that we often hear, that if people leave Adelaide and they go and live interstate or overseas, one of the first things they like to do when they come back is come back and visit the market. That sense of familiarity is definitely really important as our foundation, but we also need to continue to evolve like we have over the decades to make sure that we get that next generation of shoppers coming through.
In recent years, newcomers purely at Kangaroo Island have set up shop at the market. Jane Harmon is manager of the stall.
There's a lot of producers that didn't have a main outlet, and we were involved with Island Pure, the sheep dairy, and saw the demand of knowing who your customer is and having a pinpoint position where we could get the yogurt and the cheeses from. So it's just then grown from there.
What do you do to stand out, I guess, and differentiate yourself when you are in this sort of mecca of food?
One big one is we've got a bar. It's a huge draw card.
Another lively newcomer is Azu from Le Souk.
Not many people in South Australia know about Algerian food. And we do home cooking, very simple food, and guess what? People enjoy it.
What's been your favourite thing about being here?
Dating my customers.
The is the symbol of hospitality in our country. Even if people that don't have nothing to give you, they will give you a date, a glass of milk or water.
While tourists flock to the market, Jody Kinnane says she's often reminded of the importance of the Adelaide Central Markets to the locals.
It was only a few months ago that I was standing at just the local traffic lights and I heard a mum talking to her daughter about the first time that she came to the Central Market and that her dad had taken her as a teenager and she was in her netball gear and she'd walked around and, you know, was probably a little bit overwhelmed, as you are when you're younger in the market, and tasting her first Kransky stick. And it was a really good reminder of not just the food that's on offer here, but the memories that it creates for generations. I think all South Australians are quite proud of it, because when you come in here, there's just that extra little bit of buzz. You feel connected to the community. It's sharing food, sharing stories, having traders with generations of history here. That really makes it a special place.
And Ross Savas says there's one thing that makes the place so special.
The people. I just love looking at all different walks of life, and you get to know them, you chat with them. Now we're serving their grandkids and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
That's Ross Savas from Conn's Fine Foods at Adelaide Central Market, ending that report from The Wire's Sarah Martin. And that's it for us at The Wire. Join us tomorrow, same time, on your local station. I'm Annie Haspel. Thanks for your company.